All right. Good afternoon. How's everyone doing? Having a good time? Yeah? All right. welcome. My name's Adam Dooley. I work as the executive chef, among a few other things across the educational and event side for the Brewers Association. We're going to do kind of a little talk here on kind of all things related to service and staffing. This came about from the last several years of questions regarding having a seminar on this, and we've kind of dodged in and out of this topic a little bit, but through some research and also talking to some friends, we've dug into some pretty good hardcore data for you guys to take away and showcase. So the overall goal here, and I'm joined up here today by Doug Miller, who is a lecturing professor at Cornell University, as well as Sarah Jane Monroe, who is based out of Washington, D.C., does a lot of restaurant training out there, as well as hosting a beer show podcast out there. Between the three of us, you're looking at over 60 years of restaurant experience, all the way from quick serve up to three Michelin star. So I'm going to bounce through the slides that we have up here and talk about the data in here, point some questions to them about how it relates to what can happen in service and in training. And our goal is going to be to do that in about 30 to 35 minutes so that we can leave at least 25 minutes for you guys to ask questions. So as we're going through this, or if you have questions that we don't cover on anything that's related to service, staffing, training, all of the operations side of it and how it relates to ultimately at the end of the day what becomes profits or the success or failure of a business, please think of those, and we'll have two microphones over here. Jess Baker, the editor for crapbeer.com, is going to be our room monitor today, so we're going to try and get to as many people as we can for those questions. So with that, we're going to dive right into this, and thank you guys for your feedback. Please continue to provide us for that for everything that you go to here. This seminar is a direct result over the last 2 years of feedback of information that you as members wanted to see presented. So we're going to go right into kind of an overview before going into some of the data where I'm going to pitch questions to Doug and Sarah Jane. So the best practices on employee retention and training, and we're going to kind of touch base on a few of these. One of the biggest ones that you'll hear us reference throughout all of this is to use proven training strategies and not guesswork. That line right there is going to come back and point to several of the things that we're going to talk about here today. All right. The other one is to create a high feedback environment. Just like I mentioned here for you all giving that feedback for us on creating these seminars, feedback in a work environment is something that we're seeing as a constant need and want from staff at every level of every business out there. The other one that you're going to hear us talk about a lot as well here is something that we've learned. And again, a lot of the information that we're going to have up here is coming from our friends at either National Restaurant Association, as well as we were able to gather data from some very large companies that have been very successful, ranging from Starbucks to General Motors to Nordstrom. And having kind of some of the data from their surveys come back can really showcase how we're going to do this. One of the biggest ones that you're going to hear us drive through this whole point is when and if you can conduct exit interviews. This is something that I've talked about, and I know Doug and Sarah have as well, with multiple people over time, is the ability to do that and what that means. So those are a couple points you're going to kind of see us reference through there among some of the other stuff that's up here. So with that, we're going to jump right into a little bit of restaurant industry review because we really haven't shared these numbers in a setting like this before. So first and foremost, one of the things that you're going to see is this trend, the restaurant industry sales looks shockingly like the brewery growth rate chart that Bart Watson showed this morning. 2017 finished with almost $800 billion in restaurant sales. You can see the growth chart, you know, going back to 1970 on here, but just look at 2000 to 2017. In 7 years, it's almost tripled. That is an insane growth rate for what's happening in restaurant sales, and will be a key pointer that you can reference to as we go through this of that, looking at that bigger question of why is it so hard to find staff. This right here is one answer to that trend. So the other one that we wanted to look at was where this is going to go and where this is going to forecast, right? So this question was for how much do you think you're going to spend on dining out will change over the next 5 years? The big takeaway for us here is that over 50%, in fact, over 60% of the people are either thinking they're going to be spending about the same or will be spending some to a lot more in dining out. So that's something to pay attention to there, is that what we're seeing there is that it's growing, right? So, Sarah, like in two of the markets that you've been most active in, between New York and D.C., mm-hmm. do you think that there's a difference between having people come in as a regular, where you see them frequently of multiple times throughout a time period, or would you say that it is becoming more of a trend of seeing new people more often?
I mean, in New York City, you are always hunting after the regulars. People that come for tourism, it kind of gets spread out, and it doesn't really fluctuate that much. With D.C., I found that it's pretty different. Yes, of course, you always want regulars, and yes, you want that retention. However, because D.C. is visited so much, and it's such a smaller footprint, and there are less options than New York City, you do definitely feel a difference.
So what we're seeing from this is kind of in that realm of building the regulars is that there's going to be a mixture in there, but it's also looking at people who are looking for the new experiences, thinking they're going to spend that more money. There's two options. They're either going to spend the money by coming back to see you, or they're going to also go and explore somewhere new. All right, so how this relates to hiring people, staffing for that, looking at what's happening. Restaurant industry sales are forecasted to go above the $900 billion mark in 2019, right? So we're seeing another growth in there. We're seeing people increase their money and spending, right? So now we're going to talk about how do you staff for this, and we're going to get into what has been some really pointed questions from you guys to us over the last couple of years of, you know, I have my concept open. We offer this. We offer that. Where are the people? 60% of people responded, the most challenging area to recruit and retain candidates are in the back of the house. Doug has been is currently a lecturing professor at Cornell. Prior to that, he was at the Culinary Institute of America in Hyde Park, New York. Doug, can you talk a little bit about what you're seeing as people coming up who are learning the back of the house trend and where they may decide to make the flip to the front of the house?
Well, I would have to say, beyond just the increase in restaurants, you're now competing against grocery stores. How many grocery stores have full kitchens, retail, and other sectors? So there is more opportunities for those individuals, and that's caused a shortage without the hospitality industry. The shortage that's happening with brew pubs and restaurants is across the board, across the country, of a shortage of kitchen individuals. That being said, that means you just have to be smarter on retaining who you have and look at alternative ways of recruitment, some non-traditional ways.
So with that, let's look at turnover. So this is kind of a thing of where our world is as far as anybody who is involved in food service aspects. And I think that this would possibly be a fair number that can go into some of the tap rooms that may have the food truck model as well, too, just from talking to several members who kind of were willing to share some of those numbers. Median average across the U.S. for turnover has been below 50%, going all the way back to 2007. Anything involving food service or in the service-related industry has been upwards of 80%. Down to a low point of in the 50s, and now back up to 73% and climbing. Turnover is one of the single highest things that can actually kill a business because it directly drains from your bottom line and your ability to consistently operate. This number is forecasted to only go up for that right now, and there's some interesting practices that are coming into play from a lot of these larger companies that are looking to what can they do to retain staff. So that number was fascinating, but what we really wanted to know is where is this turnover rate happening in departments, right, of a restaurant? So kitchen, while it's the hardest to retain, is actually not the highest turnover that we're seeing in the industry. It's actually on the counter side, as well as what we're seeing in the support side. So support side are food runners, bussers, hosts, in some cases, dishwasher assistants or secondary shifts. Those two categories there are massively shifting. So kind of something for both of you, and Sarah to start, where is this trend coming from where we're seeing it flip, where we've discovered it's hard to find a back-of-the-house employee, but it's harder to retain front of the house?
Well, the thing with the back-of-the-house employee, there's a pretty clear trajectory of where you want to go. If you are starting as a prep cook, you work your way up to a line cook, you work your way up to, you know, headline cook, sous chef, chef de cuisine, executive chef, so on and so forth, there's a clear path. And after executive chef, you can get into a lot of different kinds of opportunities. As far as a server go, there's only so far you can go. There's only so long the trajectory is. Bless you. If you're a server, you could work your way up to a bartender or a sommelier. You could work your way up to an assistant manager, AGM, general manager, that kind of thing. And breweries and taprooms, it's kind of similar. You're starting at the counter, you're working your way up to taproom manager. What happens with that person next? And furthermore, when you transition into management, you make a massive pay cut. So there are those two reasons why front of the house tends to turn over a lot. And a lot of the times, also, people who are working in the front of the house have something else going on. When you're working in the kitchen, it's a dedicated craft. This is your choice of career. Now, while we're seeing that shift in the front of the house a little bit where people choose that as a career, you still do have people working in other places. For example, in Washington, D.C., almost every server also works for a nonprofit. So.
And I would even say for dishwashers, what is their trajectory and growth? You know, they may have aspirations on something else beyond just washing dishes. Is there opportunities for them to learn and grow? And if they get a sense that it's a dead-end job, it's a higher probability that they're going to go somewhere else where they might have an opportunity for growth.
So now to get a little personal. Flipping it to the side of the staff and what is causing this turnover. Highest response back, and there's not really a way to tell of when the survey was taken, so we'll just assume it wasn't when they were walking out the door of being fired or quit. But the highest response is poor management, right, from the top down. And we can take a little bit of that of saying there's some blame in there because there's definitely ego that comes into play with everybody working there, but this does say something that's going into there. The other one that has become a hot-button topic across the board, and we've seen companies trying to find different ways to do this and manage it, is insufficient tips. And this response is actually tracking from all aspects of a restaurant, from kitchen to front of the house, because now you're seeing people becoming more a part of a tip or a tip pool or even a non-tipping restaurant, and that number is starting to increase from there. Inconsistent working hours. This one is a challenge for all of us who have operations that are open for 7 days, sometimes 14 or 21 shifts a week. Poor working conditions related directly to a lot of comments about the condition of equipment or where they felt they were at as far as for having things being fixed and or listened to that they needed to properly do their job. Interestingly enough, computer systems were a big part of an answer on this, whether it was POS systems not working or whether it was failure to update POS systems and have them consistently out there. And then kind of the one that comes in at the bottom, poor training. 24% people saying that they never received training. And we've seen this so often. In fact, I was just overseas for an event and visited a brewery in another country and sat at the bar and legitimately watched this happen where this girl came in, they gave her a sweatshirt. I watched her walk in the front door. Less than 5 minutes later, she was behind the bar. They handed her a glass. They said, this is how you pour the beer. They're all organized by number. They come in by the number. You pour the glass. You put it here. And then they literally walked away, and she was a bartender there. That's not training in any way. So kind of pitching it to both of you, Doug, starting with you on this, I think there's a huge touch between the top of the management relation to the answer all the way to the bottom of the training one.
So training is incredibly important. And, you know, it's even little things that people don't consider, like explaining to the employee where the bathroom is and when they get a break. It sounds simple, but you have to consider where that individual's coming from. And the hierarchy needs is, when am I going home, where do I eat, and how do I go to the bathroom? So when you look at training, how do you create a training program where you have measurable steps where that employee can learn, and there's a checklist on what they exactly learned, so then you can build from there. That ensures that the employee has knowledge on the material that you want covered, and it also, if the employee down the road says, well, I never learned this, you can say, well, gee, remember in the training manual, here's the signature, we discussed it on X date, X whenever. And by doing that, that also allows the employees to know that you're serious. Like, I expect you to know this material. I'm not just saying it to saying it. It's like, it's a written document, and you signed off on it, therefore you should know it.
Sarah?
Yeah, I mean, anytime I've worked with clients and I ask, you know, what is your training protocol? And they say, well, they follow so-and-so, who's our best server for the night, and then that's it. It's laughable. That's not acceptable training. Not only is that person not set up for success, but it shows that you really don't care about the well-being of that person. When you invest in somebody with training, it should take a lot of time. It should take a lot of effort on the part of management. Training is not only hard for the trainee, but it should be hard for management. It should create extra work for you because they will notice that investment of time and energy and effort. So when somebody walks in the door to begin training, they should have materials already at their disposal as far as a training manual or expectations. There should be a clear training schedule with expectations at the end of each day, and that a manager should do that checkout with them so that there is communication going on, not just, hey, you covered all of this information, yes, okay, how are you doing? Checking in with the employee throughout the training process so that they know that you care and that they know that you are invested in them.
All right, so going for even more focus on front of the house and a very specific question of why servers quit their last restaurant job. Pay is always going to be at the top of the lines for almost anything of why people leave. Whether it's hourly pay or tips, not enough. Stressful environment popped up in here, which I found interesting. I would personally tie that back directly to management and how to create that, especially with the industry that we work in. Brew pubs, breweries with restaurants, tap rooms, these are busy, high-volume places. There's a way to run it where there's stress in a way that is not something that is negative. Lack of career advancement is one that is definitely in there, and creating positions for people so they stay with you longer. Unsatisfied with benefits and perks was definitely up there high enough. This is something that is also, again, a huge conversation about how much time and how much money each person can put into the benefits and the perks. There's also something in there to realize that a benefit and a perk doesn't have to be tied to a tangible high investment on the business owner side. There can be other benefits that are low cost, low impact, that make the employee feel well regarded. And I think we'll get into that in a second here on that. I did want to point out on here that as far as for a lot of people in the front of the house, very, very, very low percentage say not trained enough. So that to me actually points out something different that I want to directly ask both Doug and Sarah on here, coming from an education standpoint on this, is that just because they're saying they weren't trained enough doesn't mean that they were trained. A lot of people will come into a job and say, yeah, I got this. Don't worry about it. I've been doing this for 5 years, 10 years, 2 years. Oh, I took a course on this or a class on this. But there's a difference in training for your concept and for how you tell your story and share your story. So how do you approach that answer of saying, people coming in saying, I'm good, I don't need training, I'm ready to go?
One of my favorite scary expressions when people say, oh, it's easy, I got it, I know what to do, right? And they've only been there for like 2 days. When they say it's easy, that's when I get scared. Because the reason being is, okay, they might bring certain skills, but do they even understand your culture? You know, what is your mission? What are you, who are your clients? Those are things that you still need to train those individuals to understand what your operation is. Because they might be bringing in preconceived good and or bad skills and good or bad mindsets that you need to be aware of and train them to say, okay, you might know how to do this from a previous job. This is the way we handle this. This is our culture. This is our work environment. You know, and you really have to make sure they understand what your culture is.
Yeah, when hiring, when I see somebody with like 15 years of restaurant experience, that's almost a harder hire than somebody who's never worked in restaurants before. Because somebody who's never worked in restaurants before, you can kind of mold and shape to your exact standards because they don't even know how to carry a glass on a tray. Whereas if somebody's worked in restaurants for 15 years, they're going to have certain practices and certain habits kind of ingrained in them that you have to unteach. So that tends to be very difficult. That's not to say you shouldn't hire people with a lot of experience. But it is a harder practice, and getting them to buy into the way you do things is very hard. And the only way to do that is to have explanations for why you do things a certain way. Why you serve certain beers in certain glassware, why you use a coaster, why explaining the story behind every little thing really does make a difference. It solidifies your culture, it solidifies your mission, and it lets people know exactly what kind of experience you're hoping to provide for your guests, because every single small action, whether it's how you clear a table, how you maintain the bar, translates right back to that goal, is how you want your guests to feel.
So, some numbers to talk about the cost of turnover, right? What this means directly to you, all right? So, essentially, you're looking at a number of 16% of an annual salary to replace, hire, and train an hourly employee. So, to put that into a hard number, a $10 an hour employee, which is at or below around the minimum wage across the board, would cost your business almost $3,400 by the time you have fixed this problem. So I think this is something that's really good to point out and focus on for a minute of, it's not going through and saying, oh, I just lost somebody at this, we're gonna pick up this little blip, we're not gonna see it. This number directly affects your bottom line. A restaurant with insanely high turnover will not last long. Mid-range management positions, floor managers, assistant kitchen managers, sous chefs, bar managers. A manager making $40,000 a year will cost your business $8,000 to replace, okay? Now take the jump to somebody you've got that's a GM, or if you have multiple units, a director of operations, right? If you have a GM that's making $100,000 a year, that can cost you as much as $200,000 to replace that person. So factored into that are a couple key things to talk about. When you have management turnover, you often see a trickle-down effect of other positions in there, and that is what affects that number, right? Part of that number of saying that you could lose up to $200,000 is that if you lose a manager or a general manager that's been in place and has built and cultivated a staff and they leave, you're going to see a trickle-down of either staff leave or a staff shift or somebody else new come in that may make changes or bring people with them. Right, so there's something to be said in that training atmosphere for that. So as we look at ratcheting up the positions there, there's something to be held for that retention of management. So, you know, kind of looking at a little bit of the education side of it and where this comes back to it, who in the game of kind of retaining staff here, The owner should be retaining the managers, and the managers should be retaining the staff. Can you talk a little bit about that vertical relationship that's there, of how that works, of the trickle down from what the owner should do, how they should work that through the manager, and then how the managers should inspire the staff there so that these numbers stay down?
So I think making sure that you constantly have good communication and good check-in with every single person on your staff is very, very important. When you are an owner or very, very executive manager, you should be checking in with your managers, you know, at least once a day, even if it's by email, and then, you know, once a week, in either one-on-one meeting or, you know, as a group, to make sure that you're airing things on both sides that you need to talk about, or you are talking about what's going on, and communication is staying strong. And then as far as managers communicating with the staff, again, making sure that they're checking in every day with the staff members, either one-on-one or as a group. Some of you may or may not have pre-shift or lineup or something before the doors open, so that you can communicate about what's new, what's going on, people can raise concerns. But more importantly, when you bring on a new hire, checking in with that person to make sure that they are on the trajectory that you want them to be on. Checking in the first week, in the first month, 6 months, 1 year, that kind of thing. It doesn't have to be a formal review or anything like that, but making sure that you're helping them get to the role that that they would like to get to, and that you're essentially trying to hire future managers. Promoting from within is crucial, money-saving, wonderful practice. So if you're hiring somebody who's going to be, you know, cleaning the tap room, you would like to maybe one day have that person running the tap room. So making sure that you're getting them there gradually, and communication and checking in are the two ways to do that.
And the other flip side to look at this is from a customer standpoint. You know, if you have high turnover, that customer's now saying, wait, what happened to that server I had yesterday? Or wasn't there another manager here? So that starts putting doubt in that consumer's mindset of, all right, what's going on with this business? There's high turnover. I don't know anybody here. Why do I want to come back? So some of those financial implications are consumers start to not want to spend the money or get concerned when they see that turnover. So, you know, when people say, and this kind of goes back to training, oh, we don't have money for training, you know, budgets are tight. Well, if you lose that employee, how much money are you going to spend to replace that employee, which could have been saved by doing proper training in the first place? In regards to that relationship between ownership or owner and your general manager or manager, whatever it may be, that should, as mentioned, that should be an ongoing conversation. So there are no surprises of situations because you're commuting with each other on a regular basis. You know, are you sitting down and having meetings in a closed door setting, not on the floor, not at the bar, but some place where real dialogue can take place that is not disturbed by a wide range of different types of things, so that everybody is exactly on the same page and there's a shared information from the manager to the owner and the owner to the manager on a whole wide range of different topics, financial, employee, incentives, goals, things of that nature.
I think this slide can also reference something really important of making sure that the hire that you do is the right hire. You know, I think everybody here should be familiar with the term of a Band-Aid hire. That can affect this number even greatly when you're just like, the person was here, they were a warm body, we just needed it to get through, right? Everybody's been there and everybody will be there at some point in time. But looking at these numbers and where that is and having that in the back of your mind of looking to build the team and looking at what an actual interview is, just because there's a warm body sitting across from you doesn't necessarily mean that person should be joining your team. All right, so on to kind of the job searcher part of it and flipping it around to the people who are out there looking for jobs. Time it took to find the most current and recent job. Average is between 1 to 4 weeks. I think a lot of people would potentially disagree with that. Fascinatingly enough, 10% say 1 day. Yeah, right? and then you have your longer-term ones where it's going plus 3 months and in there. But you're looking at anywhere from putting an ad out on one day to having that run for up to 4 weeks. I think this is important to look at because everybody puts an ad out, whether it's on Craigslist or whether it's on Indeed or Glassdoor or culinary job postings that are starting to come out there, like Poached that's in a few cities. People expect instant return, right? And a lot of people that I talk to are like, okay, I put the ad up. When are the resumes and applications going to start coming in, right? So what would you say is a reasonable expectation of saying, I'm looking to hire somebody, time frame of having that person actually start the job? Let's assume this is a person that you're wanting should fit the company. How long should you plan to have a job search for?
Well, one thing I would say, anybody that applies, you should be getting back to them within 24 hours, right? Because you're competing against how many other places did they apply for. So even just communicating, you know, thank you very much, you know, when do you have time to set up, to have a conversation, a meeting? So within 24 hours, just getting back to them saying, hey, when can you come in? Once they do get in, depends on state, you know, if you have to do drug testing, things of that nature, and figuring out the schedule, you know, after that meeting, can they start in a week or two, depending on their schedule? But the important thing is to starting that initial conversation. They want to hear back from you as a possibility for employment. So 24 hours, get back to them.
Absolutely.
I mean, in my experience, I've budgeted a month and a half for a line employee. So that means, you know, somebody who's hourly. And I've budgeted anywhere from 3 to 6 months for a management employee. It takes a lot. And I 100% agree with Doug in that, you know, response is key. It really starts you off on the right foot. And furthermore, response of, you know, thank you, but no thank you. Making sure that you have a template or something like on the ready. So that you can already be giving that feedback, so that you're already building a reputation of, you know, an employer who knows how to properly respond to people.
So here's a myriad of fun numbers for people who are looking for hiring people. Top aspects when considering a job: enough hours, pay, growth, location. Location is huge now. The other one that stands out to me on here, and is something that should go into everybody's forecasting model, 48% of people currently looking for a job in the restaurant industry or in this kind of service-focused industry expect their next job to last less than 3 years. That needs to go into everybody's planning. That's not a long time. 88%, going back to what Sarah had mentioned earlier, are open to working multiple jobs in order to get more hours. And here's a fun one for considering where you're putting your applications out and where you're searching. 72% of people use a mobile phone to look or apply for jobs. So now we're starting to get into the application process and what it takes to hire somebody and how easy it is for them to get to you. The more challenging you make it for them to apply for the job, the less applications you're going to get, and the more people will move on to the next one that's out there. Over half the people are looking for full-time work, which is anything right now classified as above is 36 hours or above. So kind of looking at this methods tools in the job search thing, right? 72% mobile, 70% desktop, 50% still had to fill out a paper application, either online or when they went in. And then here's a pretty fascinating one. 43% walk into the employer. So how open are you to receiving people when they come in and they stop at the host stand and they say, hey, I'm looking for a job? You know, what's that next step there? Is there training involved for the people who are your front line of talking to that people who want to work for them? The beer business is insanely exciting. People want to get into this industry. How many of you who have breweries have had countless times where your regular guests say, I want to work here, right? So there is a little something to be said for that. So in the job search mode, right, how many different ways would you say of recommending for people, like, where do you find the idea to put a job out for your applications? And going through that, you've got training on how this happens. So how do you approach training your staff to look for people to hire?
Well, I think one, particularly, you know, with a lot of these breweries, they're in small towns or have communities that they are involved with, even communities within a large city. Part of this hiring practice, and this goes back to what Sarah's saying, is do people perceive you as do the right thing in the case of employment? So even if that person is not capable, you've knocked on your door, they want to work there, they have no skills, you don't have any for them, what's that conversation like? Can you say no and they still feel good about themselves when they walk away, even though you told them, no, you're not going to hire them? Opposed to like, yeah, sure, okay, let's go. That includes if they come into your front door. You know, have you trained your staff to say, okay, if somebody comes looking for a job, this is the process. Here's the application. You know, this is when it's available. You can even have something printed out ahead of time that has the spiel on and saying, thank you very much for filling an application. We look forward to contacting you soon, whatever it may be. So that, again, even if you say no to that individual, they still feel good about it because that just gets out into the community of saying, gee, you know what? They try to do the right thing. They can't hire everybody, but they try to do the right thing. And that helps you recruit more individuals.
Yeah, I mean, so everything that, you know, anytime I talk to a client, everything stems from what experience do you want your guests to have and what experience do you want your employees to have. And you think about guest experience, it's the first time the guest is interacting with your brand, with who you are, and that could be your website. So for a lot of people, seriously, take a look at your website. And for a lot of people, the first interaction that they're going to have with you is when they walk in the door and say, hey, I'm looking for a job, and they're encountering a host or somebody who's standing at the bar. Now, if that person's response is, oh, I don't know, okay, let me get a manager, that already looks sloppy, right? If somebody walks into your establishment and the host is like, oh, you're looking for a job? Okay, well, fill out this application. Can I get you water? And I'll be right back with my manager. They're already prepared. And it's a very easy thing to put into a training manual. If somebody walks in the front door looking for a job, this is our protocol. It's very, very simple. You hand them this thing that's in a folder right here, you give them a glass of water, and you get a manager. So it already starts off as a very efficient process, a very simple process, and it's no cost to you aside from paper.
Yeah, and echoing something that's been said, 55% of people said the most frustrating thing is not getting a response back. So if you're in a smaller community, or actually really no matter where you are, because the beer industry and the service industry are small worlds, no matter who they are, if they apply, even if you're not going to get them, keep the line of communication always open. I'm going to kind of go through these here a little bit faster so we can get to questions and hold true to that 25 minutes thing for questions here. Applications submitted before getting hired. 33% won. That means a couple things. One, the job market is super tight right now for staffing. Two, it also means that people are looking and researching where they want to look. Like what Sarah said about what's your website look, or like what both Doug and Sarah said of how does that happen when somebody comes in and starts the conversation about where they want to work at. Over 50% are three or under. So you're almost, in a sense, competing for people to have them come work for you as well. Top factors, enough hours, pay, opportunity for growth, location, all kind of factor in there. Going directly into the brewing industry, workplace atmosphere is over 50%. That's something that is really attracting people into the beer service industry. So there we go. We got it. We still have 25 minutes for questions, and we can go back through these. But please, we've got two microphones over here. Anything as far as training schedules, length of training, time of training, anything on that you want to kind of bring up or hear thoughts on, let's get a discussion going on it, and we'll kind of alternate back and forth, and we've got Jess to help moderate that. So do we have questions in the room?
Go back one slide.
Go back one. You got it.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
So this is actually really applicable. We are redoing our entire tap room management protocol and training Monday when I get home. Yay. Part of it is because we just opened a restaurant, so we have a tap room at the brewery and an actual restaurant on another side of town. We've been bringing in a lot of more restaurant standards into play for that. We have professional restaurant managers that work in that environment. One thing that I want to avoid, having run restaurants and bars too, but I've worked professionally in sales and retail for the beer industry for 10 years now. One thing that I'm trying to avoid is too much overdoing of the restaurant side in the tap room, because we're not a restaurant. I guess I'm trying to find a healthy balance between that grit and that laxness that a tap room should have versus a professional restaurant. So I guess for me, it's like, I know there are value on each side for that, and it's a company culture. It's also depends on what part of town we are on. The tap room is on a very blue-collar side of town, whereas the restaurant is on a very white-collar side of town. So I guess I'd like to hear some thoughts on that going forward to help us out with that transition.
Anything that is applied to a Michelin star restaurant can be applied to a tap room. It's all about anticipation of the guest needs. Sure, when you're in a Michelin star restaurant, you see somebody squinting a little bit, you bring over a custom tray of reading glasses from Warby Parker. Okay, you're not going to do that in a tap room. However, when you're in a tap room, people are coming to you to relax, unwind, and not have to think. They don't want to put in effort. If they wanted to put in effort, they would have stayed home and opened their own beer. So, yes, I understand what you're saying in that you don't want it to be stuffy and you don't want it to be so intimidating or pretentious in any way. However, there are little ways to still anticipate the guest needs. Making sure that you have ample menus around, making sure that water goes down immediately. You know, it's those little touches, those little things are going to make it seem a little more effortless while, you know, still maintaining the facade of, you know, this is a gritty, natural environment. But, you know, I think having people with the equipment to give somebody an off-the-charts, like, over-the-moon service experience, whether they need to actually use that or not, is always worth it.
And I'd have to add, too, I think, you know, regardless of position, everybody should have standards for every position in their operation. So I spent 10 years with Four Seasons Resort and Hotels, and we had standards for breakfast, lunch, dinner, fine dining, casual, pool, room service, etc. All those standards are slightly different based off of what the guest needs were, but there was a clear expectation based off of the needs of the guests on what should be handled when and how. So restaurant standards might be different than a tap room, but there's still clearly defined expectations of that guest experience.
Let's go over here.
Hello. So question, what are your guys' thoughts on tip sharing? Because obviously wages are kind of an issue, you know, for servers and that, but between like some different support roles, let's say somebody's maybe doing dishwashing one day and the server next day, what do you think tip sharing is actually a good thing?
It's complicated. First, it depends on legalities, tips versus service charge. Legally, those are two totally different things. Depends on local and state and federal laws. You can't force people to tip. If they so choose to, that's on the staff, but you can't dictate how they tip out either. And that's where it becomes complicated. Some outfits have gone to, like, Union Square Hospitality Group, Danny Meyer, has gone to a included tip model that works for their operation, but other restaurants have not been successful at it. It does equal some pay challenges, but how do you get that started? And also, how do you get your guests in the mindset of the tips already included?
In the past, and double check with what your requirements are for tipping. In the past, when I've had a staff member go from like support role to server role, and they fluctuate back and forth depending on the day, their hourly rate changes. You know, so if they're an assistant server, the hourly rate will be higher. Their tip, you know, what percentage of the tips they're getting is lower. As a server, the hourly rate is lower, but the amount of tips that they're getting is higher. There are certain states where it dictates that, you know, for example, whoever's getting tipped has to spend at least 30% of their time interfacing with the guest. So number one is just check what you're allowed to do.
I think from there, the most important thing in this too is get your staff involved in that conversation early. Never have that become a top-down decision. You need to make them feel a part of that decision. Otherwise, it gets very kind of grabby as this is my money. So it's always important to start having that conversation early. Go over here.
My question's about hiring and attracting good candidates. Do you guys have specific examples of benefits or perks that restaurants maybe didn't offer or didn't offer strong options for, whether it's healthcare or sales rewards programs that are now being beefed up to attract better candidates, and any out-of-the-box perks? Like, I'm from Boston. The transit system is terrible. It shuts down before most restaurants are out. Some restaurants are offering gas cards or, you know, Uber fares, stuff like that. Any examples you guys have of perks that are being offered now that maybe we haven't seen in the past? I'd love to hear.
I'm going to jump in first. Sorry. Okay. One thing on that is when you put your ad up, think about how you're posting your ad. And if you are offering, whatever you offer, list it. Do not just write with benefits. List it. Because you got to have that initial competing thing. So then, go.
Yeah. Yes, you're seeing a lot of different restaurants beef up what they're offering, and it almost becomes, you know, right now in DC, there's so many different restaurants opening. Here you are. There we go. It becomes you almost like line up the restaurants and compare the benefits. Okay, these guys cover health, they have 401k matching, but they don't do dental, or they do vision, or whatever it is. So what makes people stand out are the benefits that are a little more unique. And breweries, I find, are really embracing that, because you have the option to get really, really creative. You have the option to offer, you know, free off-flavor courses, or if you guys ever get a collection of tickets to go to a festival because you're participating, instead of bringing that random bro of yours, bring one of your employees. You know, you've got a lot of options to get involved in the community, you know, creating a cycling club or a bowling league or, you know, whatever. I know there's a brewery in Boulder that assists with helping people buy houses because they want their people to, you know, stay within Boulder because it's hard to train up new people, and Boulder's really hard to buy houses apparently because it's expensive. Yeah.
I don't know why you're looking at me.
I don't know. You live in Boulder. Because you live in Boulder. So not only are they, you know, assisting people and helping buy houses by offering them, you know, free legal advice or free housing advice or, you know, what have you. So there are so many different options for you to get creative with benefits that speak to the culture that you want to build.
Another thing I have to add, too, is obviously dental, 401k, but there's even small little benefits you can do on a daily basis. You know, just understanding who that employee is, and do they have kids? You know, what are the kids' names? You know, are they in Little League? Oh, great. You know, your son's in a Little League. Your daughter's in this activity. Oh, they're having a fundraiser. Well, here's a case of beer to help raise funds for their whatever kids' event. You know, small little things like that can add different types of benefits, more than just financial.
Did you have a question?
My question was just what he said.
Okay.
I'm back in Brazil, and we do a lot of birthday parties there. So they're all looking for who wants to give more free stuff. So I was wondering if here in America,
yes, everyone is always looking for free stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I think targeted, where, you know, you're giving free stuff to something that is important to your employees is a win-win, because then they feel proud and good about where they work at, because you're supporting something that they're personally involved with.
And having, sorry, real quick, just having the conversation with your employee and having a constant conversation of what are you working towards? What are your goals? And how can I help you get there? So if your employee is, you know, pouring beers in your tap room, but they say, oh, I really want to be a master brewer one day or something like that, catering the benefits to kind of help them get there. Or if they say, I'm a server right now, eventually I never want to work in restaurants, I only want to work in this nonprofit, cool, what are some skills that you need to develop to be more marketable for nonprofit? Do you need to have social media experience? Great. We can have you do some social media posts and give you credit. Or you can, if you're really good enough, take over the social media. So giving people the tools that they need to kind of get their goals builds that relationship more.
Yes, sir.
We have a really small tap room and brewery, and we have actually pretty good employee retention. Mm-hmm. But one of the problems that, or it's not a problem yet, but we have a lot of employees who would like their sisters, aunts, cousins, uncles to come to work with us. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah. Well, that's why going back to is developing that frank conversation and how do you say no and they still feel good about it. So it doesn't be like, well, gee, you don't want to hire my cousin because of whatever reason, which is being part of that community. And if it is a right fit, then you might hire them. If it's not, then you have to be up frank and say, you know what, we just don't have anything available for them right now. We'll keep it in mind in consideration for down the road.
Also having very clear descriptors of what is expected for the job sometimes helps people eliminate themselves. Oh, I really want to be your taproom manager. Cool, this is the job description, and these are the requirements, and this is what you're going to be doing on a daily basis. If you're good with all that, then we'll have a conversation. And 9 times out of 10, they'll look at it and be like, oh, actually, I don't know how to read a P&L statement. You know.
I think in going down into that role, because a lot of us have had that happen, and there are some benefits to it, one of the big downfalls of it is then you commonly get the thing of, we want the same days off, oh, we're all going on vacation together, and you've got a small staff and you can't make that happen. So you have to make sure that the conversation happens with them before being hired, that they cannot be treated as a unit at the workplace, because that'll create a lot of conflict with the rest of your staff. And that actually becomes one of the bigger challenges that stops it from that of going, you don't get the same days off, and if all three of you request 2 weeks off, it's not going to happen. But it is definitely, it has its pluses and minuses, and is something to take into a lot of consideration. Yes, sir?
Yeah. I'm just wondering if you guys have any effective strategies or tips about how to handle sick days and vacation days, because I find that is something that just, I end up not being prepared for, and then burning out either myself or other employees trying to cover those things. So if you guys have any effective strategies on how to deal with that, I would love to hear it.
One thing is you build it into your P&L statement, the cost of cost of sick days and cost of vacation days, figuring out what that, looking at past history and percentages of building that in just to your cost of operations, so you can at least financially account for it and not have you hit you at the end of the year.
Also having a clear expectation, your sick days are accrued and this is how they're accrued, or you have this many vacation days after 6 months or 1 year of employment, so that it's very clear. You can say, hey, if you're going to take a vacation day, you have to give us 2 weeks notice so that we can staff accordingly. Also, a lot of times if you have former employees that you have a good relationship with that are, working outside of restaurants. Sometimes, this is just a random one-off suggestion, but sometimes you get them to come in for a day or so because they miss the fun of it and they're sick of their 9-to-5 already. I don't know. but being very, very clear from the get-go what the policy is, what the expectations are, so everyone has a conversation going into it.
Documenting it as well. a lot of staff don't realize how often they call in sick or how often they move a shift around, but documenting it and either having it show up on their paycheck or when you have a check-ins with them and saying, hey, are you aware that in the last 30-day pay period, you missed 3 shifts? People have that aha moment. When they're in the moment of it, they're like, oh, I'm bailing out of my shift. They go on it while you remember it for months or sometimes years ahead of time. They literally forget about it the next morning they wake up. So it's on you as an employer to remind them of how much they're using or what they're doing, and also how it affected things. Really put that team effort into it of like, you hurt the shift. And that resonates. When it just goes under the bridge and nobody decides to address the issue, then they'll become more and more repeat offenders on it because they think it's easier.
Awesome. Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Sure.
What we do is we assign a shift and so I don't end up working on the sick days because they're calling the other people on the call list. And then if they call four people, then they can call me. So yeah. Put the onus on them.
Yes.
Thanks. So I had a comment and a question. The question had already been asked since I got up here. And one of the things that I've worked with Upslope, and we are in Boulder, so we are the brewery that you were talking about, so thanks for the plug. And yeah, we found, it's just more or less a comment, is that we found the beer market is extremely competitive. There's a lot of breweries in Boulder and Denver, and having a large benefit package or a competitive benefit package has really helped us to acquire different talent. And the home buying program is one of them. And then also, I have found over the last 10 years of interviewing people, why do you want to work at Upslope? You know, it used to be, oh, I love beer, right? And like, you guys probably get that all the time. I love beer. I like drinking beer. That's why I want to work at a brewery. Use your brand. The brand is really, really important in the culture of Upslope, and I assume with everyone else in this room. And over the course, over the last few years, I've really seen a shift with comments of being like, hey, you guys are very outdoor-focused, so are we. This latest round of interviews, I would say 80-85% of the people mentioned they're applying to us because we're a B Corp. And that was a really big, kind of a compelling reason. So every market, obviously, is going to be very different. But for here, for us, that was a really big thing. So my comment, I guess, essentially is, the brand is really, really valuable to be able to recruit people and have them stick around. So,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Thank
you.
Sorry, it's me again.
No.
Mostly just because I've worked in casual places. I work in actually on the weekends in a fine dining restaurant. So I try to bring some of these stuff into it. So here's another thing we're going through. Prior to recently, we tip pooled for the whole week. So essentially, they took all the tips from the whole week and divvied it out per how many hours you worked. We're getting rid of that. It creates complacency, and also it does not foster accountability. So we're going away from that. Saying that, we're talking about going to starting with a daily tip pool and then eventually a shift-based tip pool per normal. We don't pay out cash every night. We predominantly are credit card based. So any tips, any opinions or tips you have for that as far as that transition goes and how to approach that subject with our employees, mostly because I know that we will get some pushback from that.
Be open and honest and explain what your reasoning is. It will be bumpy. And there'll be possibly some pushback, but the best you can do is just being open and honest with them.
I have a little question for you. So I'm just surprised that they were cool with that. Because the thing is when you tip pool for the entire week, you've got, you know, people work on Monday night versus people work on Friday night. Like Monday night people had a lot easier shift. Friday night people got slammed and obviously brought in a lot of tips. So there's actually a discussion going on right now among some restaurants in DC. They're getting away from daily pool shares where, you know, AM and PM, it's all shared because they have such a dedicated AM staff and such a dedicated PM staff. It's really not fair. I couldn't see somebody being upset with that, aside from the people that are only working on Monday nights.
Not to cut you off, but we actually have to end because we're at our time. But we can take that, and we can talk to you guys offline here in a second. But I do have to end on time for that. But thank you guys for attending. Have an absolutely great rest of your conference, and thank you all for coming out.